Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Facing 30. I'm your host, Kat Wilson, and it has been 62 days since I turned 30. Woo, what a ride it's been. I'm very excited to introduce my guest this week, Mr. Mike Osterhout, local artist, musician, and just all-around great guy. So glad that he's my neighbor and that he took the time to come all the way up the road to be on the podcast. He really is an excellent human being. You may know him from Church of the Little Green Man, which is a fantastic space for music, art, and just general community right up the road here in Mountaindale. You'll be hearing a sample of his band, Purple Jesus, before our interview. It's pretty great. So enjoy that. You'll also hear him on the way out after the interview. If you like the music, let me know. Maybe I'll hook you up with some, or maybe he knows where to get it because I have the only copy of this album. He lent it to me. It's always great to learn about people's past. And one of the reasons I love this podcast is it's very rare that you sit down with someone for an hour or more and ask them about their lives. That can be kind of awkward and intense, especially in just a general social setting. So that's what's special about interviews, is you're taking the time to really get to know someone. And I'm always left wanting more, because I find that the more you get to know someone, the more fascinating they are, the more you find you may have in common or you don't have in common, which just makes the world a more interesting place. I'm really glad that I get to also have such cool neighbors. It's a good life. Can't complain, except, you know, about the state of the planet, but it'll be fine. I'm really proud that I voted. Actually, I voted right after the interview with Mike. Way to go, New York. It's been a rough year, and I really think that people kind of got out and voted, whatever it was you believe in. Like, people are realizing you need to participate more on the smaller level, because local elections do matter. And I like knowing the people I'm voting for. I actually knew some of the people on the ballot, so that's exciting. I may not even like half of them, but that doesn't matter, because I took the time to get to know them, their stance. I got to know the issues on the back of the ballot. And it's important, because what you do affects the people around you. So anyway, I want to get right into it with Mike. Please enjoy the interview and have a great day. Oh, don't forget, go to iTunes if you can. I'm on there, Facing 30. If you rate this podcast, it makes it more visible to other people that might enjoy it. I don't do this for money. There's zero sponsors. I don't have a ton of listeners. I really do it for the passion of it. And I would love to get more feedback. So if you have any thoughts, suggestions, praise, criticism, please feel free to share. Because that's the whole part of the creative process. I don't, you know, like being alone doing this, but it's the nature of a podcast. It's a kind of a solo act unless you have a partner. Anyway. Okay, have a great day. Enjoy the interview with Mike Osterhout.
Mm-hmm. I am.
You are the most punctual guest I've ever had.
I'm very punctual.
I love it.
Always have been.
That's awesome. So, Mike Osterhout, welcome to Facing 30.
Thank you.
It's awesome to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
You've been one of my favorite neighbors for a while now.
Well, you are too, although I didn't know you were that close.
Yeah. Most people didn't even realize that, you know, this house is here.
Yeah. We're like 3 miles away.
I have had several people come here at night, and they're like, where... This driveway is so creepy. But thanks for coming. So, have you ever listened to the podcast at all?
I haven't. I'm sorry.
My mom has been on this podcast twice, and she's never listened until this last episode. So,
I've got some catching up to do.
You are absolved. Don't worry about it. No. So the whole point originally of the podcast was to talk about my existential crises about facing 30.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I have faced 30, I still, I was going to end it at my 30th birthday, but it really became more of like a chronicle of all these awesome people and events in my life in this mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to keep going until my 31st birthday.
Good.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure you'll find an excuse to keep going past that.
No, actually, I have a whole nother podcast planned.
Oh,
but okay. I wanted to do a few more in this format and just really wrap it up.
Uh-huh.
And then I have like a whole new project that will actually I'll be doing anonymously.
So is your existential crisis gone now that you are 30?
No. No. I mean, it's... That's a weird one. I don't know if what you went through in your late 20s, but I was facing like a just feeling like a big failure,
uh-huh.
pretty much. Uh-huh. And I feel like less of a failure after doing this podcast because I've talked to so many people who are like, oh, no, you're fine.
Good, that's good. Great. Did you interview mostly people under 30?
No.
No.
I would say it's about 50-50. A lot of my friends, like, I realized it wasn't about... I originally started with the goal of doing under 30 and mm-hmm. then realized that it doesn't really matter how old you are because we've all been through what I was going through.
Right.
So
right.
became less about me and more about I just wanted to talk to people about it.
Uh-huh.
So I want to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, 30, I mean, you know, it's over half a lifetime away from me, you know. So it's back there, but I do remember it, you know. It was one of those, you know, facing 30, you're kind of always facing 30 by the time you turn, say, 16, you know,
yeah.
and, you know, 30 at 16 seems so far away and so ancient and you, I don't know whether, you know, society does it or families do it or whatever, but by 30, you know, at least growing up in a small town, you got two or three kids, you got a mortgage, you got a car, or most of my friends did, and I took a different route, you know. So by 30, I had been married and divorced. I was living in California.
Hmm.
I had moved from here, from the East Coast. And so it was a whole different, you know, kind of... what way of measuring your life, you know, because I had no car. I had a car, but I had no mortgage. I had no kids. I was divorced. I was on my own. And I measured it by career, you know, that hopefully by 30, I would be, you know, on my way art world wise. And, you know, you hit 30 and you pass 30 and all those things are kind of still, you know, in the ether and you're still trying to measure yourself, you know, by maybe the way other people measure things.
Yeah.
So, but as I remember it, 30 was a good one, you know, like, you know, you go through a lot of struggles in your 20s and you kind of hit 30, you know, I think I hit it, you know, running. You know, I was out of art school. I'm trying to exactly think. So 30 would be 82. Living in San Francisco, out of art school, running a gallery, and attending seminary. So I was doing things.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You were attending seminary?
I had gotten my MFA out of the San Francisco Art Institute, and my work had begun to mutate into this interest in religion, you know, that I was using for my, you know, conceptual work. You know, I was using religion kind of formally the way the Renaissance artists would use it, only I'm using it as a conceptualist and as a modernist or postmodernist. And so I needed to know more. I needed to know more about religion. I had a very, you know, kind of non-religious upbringing, you know, went to church and Presbyterian,
yeah.
you know, covered dish kind of religion. And so I decided to go to seminary as an art project. So I applied to Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, and it ended up doing a year in seminary, like postgraduate study.
So was it more of like a logical or just kind of a curiosity for you, or was it also spiritual?
No, it was more formal curiosity. Okay. You know, I wanted, it was a scholarly approach, you know, not a faith approach, you know. So that being the case, I was the oddball in the seminary because, you know, it was a, excuse me, it was part of the Graduate Theological Union. So there was 10 different seminaries that I could study in. I could study with the Baptists, I could study with the Franciscans, I could study with the Jesuits. Each one had a little different approach. And but it, like I said, it wasn't a faith-based, you know, study. So at first they rejected me. They thought I was anti-Christian. You know, I'm applying to seminary with artwork like blood prints from tattoos and pieces of my dead cow and, you know, works that were even edgy for the Art Institute, let alone, you know, a seminary. So they rejected me at first, but then when I appealed the case and I told them, look, you know, my approach, I'm qualified. I have my master's degree and my approach is scholarly. I want to learn, but I want to learn with the functionaries. I didn't want to just go to Cal and study theology. You know, I wanted to learn with the nuns and the priests and the ministers that were studying. So
people who dedicated their whole lives.
Yeah,
to them.
The functionaries, you know, I wanted to learn alongside them, see what they were learning, you know. So it was incredibly interesting, but it was a very schizophrenic lifestyle because at the same time I'm running a very fringy art gallery in the Mission, you know, in San Francisco. So it was like both, you know, I would get on the BART and study and talk about God all day and then go back to my debauched, you know, artist lifestyle, you know, for the rest of the time.
What was the art scene like in San Francisco at that time?
Well, it was, excuse me, kind of fused with the punk rock scene. So it was really, really interesting. My teachers and the mentors came out of the conceptual scene out of L.A. and San Francisco. So people like David Ireland and Howard Fried, Linda Montano, even Chris Burden, Paul McCarthy, they would come and go. So I was, you know, that group was a little bit older than me, and they were the ones that, you know, I was gravitating towards.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there was another group that was a little bit younger than me that was the punk rock scene, the musicians. And I'd never played music. I'd never... you know, I didn't study music. I didn't know how to play an instrument or anything, but I was completely enthralled with this idea that anybody could be a musician, you know, and it melded perfectly with like Joseph Beuys, you know, the German artist who, you know, had the same kind of approach with anybody can be an artist and his approach to social sculpture. So my approach as a conceptualist was kind of to take from both communities, you know, and it was exciting at the time. Tony Labatt, Karen Finley, you know, a bunch of us were all kind of working at the same time, and we started to work outside of the system. So we weren't all showing in galleries. We were looking for site specific installation type of work, you know. So it was an exciting time.
Were there a lot of like outdoor? Because you've posted some photos from like the 80s and 90s I've seen on Facebook, I think,
mm-hmm.
for like outdoor pieces and installations.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot of that out there?
Well, outdoor, maybe not specifically outdoor, but outside of the traditional spaces,
yeah.
You know. You know, it was in the days where it was, I guess, the economics of it, whatever. But, you know, I would... call some, you know, I would find a space I like an abandoned JCPenney building, you know, department store that had big department store windows. Turned out Bob Lurie, who actually was this millionaire who owned the Giants, he owned the place.
Uh-oh.
I called him up, you know, and it was in the days where you could call somebody up and, you know, they would answer the phone,
yeah.
You know, so I rented those windows and put performances in them. So it was in, you know, we would do things like a lunchtime performance because it was It wasn't, I guess it would be considered the financial district at the time, but it would be like, you know, all the buildings around there would let out, you know, for lunch. And so you'd have a built-in crowd that would see your work, whether it was a performance work or a installation, what have you, you know. So I was always interested in reaching communities kind of outside of the art community. You know, it's fun to show in galleries and it's fun to show with your peers and everything, but to me it's more gratifying to show outside of that structure and find another community that has absolutely no point of reference as this is art or this isn't, you know, who knows what it is, but, you know, try to tap into those kind of communities.
Yeah. I find that reaching the art community. So for me, I never went to art school. I like to go to museums and things like that, but I don't know much about famous artists or where to find their work or what they've done in the past. And I think that a lot of that has to do with, I think the art world has become more insulated again.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to access for some people. I mean, I grew up in suburbia. There was not a lot of art going on.
Right, right. And art is, kind of by definition, at least the modern art is an urban thing. Mm. You know, you're not going to find much in the country. You know, growing up in a small town, you know, I was lucky enough in the 60s to have a couple of, what do you call them, field trips to the city, you know. So I remember going to, I think, the Modern and the Whitney, and it was at a time when Warhol and Rauschenberg and, you know, these kind of marquee names these days were just coming up. And they were, you know, they were having big shows in museums. And, you know, pop art was just happening, you know. So to see that at a very young age was inspiring to me, you know. But I agree that, like, the art world is unto itself. And more so these days on some levels, and then on other levels, it's been kind of co-opted by pop culture. Mm. And you know who Banksy is, you know, it's like certain artists have, you know, kind of, you know, crossed over into pop culture. You know who Warhol is, you know, and then, but you probably don't know who Joseph Beuys is. You may not know who Yves Klein is. You know, these other artists that, you know, someone in the field would know, or right, art historian would know. You know, the general public has no clue. Yeah.
I wonder how you can make, I mean, there, for a rural area, we have more art galleries than we had where I grew up in Colorado, with, you know, four times the population in one town.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting. Do you think that's because of its proximity to New York City?
Yeah, I think the idea of having an art gallery is not so foreign 80 miles outside of New York City. And there's also, I mean, you know, really we don't have much around here. But you go over to Beacon, there's Dia Beacon. You go up to Hudson, there's a bunch of galleries there. You go up to Woodstock, there's probably a few more. So there are these enclaves, you know, in New York State that it also comes out of the sense of artist colony. Like Woodstock is, you know, artist colony goes back to the 20s. Hudson, not so much. Hudson was like a dumpy little town that, you know, some people moved into and put some money into. Before you know it, you got a nice little main street with, you know, and then, you know, it's also the so-called real art world, you know, will go to the Hamptons, they'll go to Hudson, and you know, kind of make that their weekend place. And so you'll see the same people, you know, that you see, you know, in the art world in the city, you'll see them in Hudson or you'll see them in the Hamptons. Not so much here. But here it's I like that, you know. I like the fact that we're a little bit off the beaten path, you know,
and that we're
kind of a blank slate here, you know. We'll see what happens, you know. And we're going through, you know, now with the casino coming, now with maybe Legoland, all these things, you know, are popping up. You know, there's going to be more and more attention paid to this area. So we'll see, you know, see what happens.
I find that this place is where artists come to hide.
Yeah, a little bit.
Because I've run into so many celebrities and artists up here, and you know, producers and directors. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, I worked in restaurants, so they eat at some point, and then I see them. But It's always amazing to me because I can still drive. I was just driving around the other day and I found roads I'd never knew existed in whole neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Because people just hide away.
Right, right. And I didn't take that approach. I came up here to work, you know.
Yeah.
So when I came up here in 95, you know, there was very, very few people up here, you know. The flight out of the city post 9/11 hadn't happened, you know. So in those, but I came not to, I mean, I guess I did come to escape the city to a degree, you know. I'd lived there 10 years probably at that point, and I was ready to move out, but I didn't come up here, to hide. I came up here to work, you know, and as I, I'm up here 20 years plus now, and I want to work more. I want to be, I want to have more of a profile up here, and I want to bring more people to have an option, almost an aesthetic option from urbanism that the art world doesn't have to be restricted to just the urban experience,
right.
And with that said, the rural world doesn't need to be marginalized. The rural aesthetic doesn't mean marginalized into this kind of outsider aesthetic.
Hmm.
You know, it's like we can, you know, I think we have the potential here, to really experiment with that and see if maybe there can be a meeting of both worlds, you know.
Well, you're working on that, and I want to get to Church of Little Green Man in a second here, but mm-hmm. What drew you up here in the first place?
It's home.
Yeah.
I grew up in Montgomery, you know, which is maybe 30 miles from here. Family had a place at Wolf Lake, which is like 10 miles from here. So it's home for me. And because I had spotted that church maybe 8 or 9 years before I moved out of the city, when it came up for sale, the timing was right. And I was able to buy it and move up, and I never looked back.
What did you like about that church?
The Church of Little Green Man, we had started as a, you know, kind of performance art congregation on the Lower East Side in 86, along with my band Purple Jesus. So it was already a project, and I saw the buying of an actual church as, okay, let's take it to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, let's actually, you know, put it in a church and see what happens.
That's
and
crazy.
It took about 15 years to do that. You know, I had to completely renovate the church and put new roofs on, and, you know, and just life, you know, kind of interfered with doing the whole thing. But since, I guess we've been doing it up here now, maybe 7-8 years. So about 2010, we started it up. And so it became it became something way different than it was on the Lower East Side. And at the same time, it was exactly the same. And the old timers, a few of them from the Lower East Side, now live up here or now have secondary homes. And then there's a completely new community, you know, yourself included, you know, with a lot of, you know, people in their 30s and 40s and even 20s and kids, which is actually, it's become a country congregation, you know.
Yeah. The following seems to have grown in the last few years.
Yeah, it's getting bigger all the time.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
This last one I went to, was it the last one of the season that you filmed for people there with cameras?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Roderick Angle is still working on a little documentary.
Oh, that's exciting.
So he's, we've been doing interviews and luckily he hit a good church. So
yeah, no, that was great. And I think it's been interesting because I've been going there since I worked at Trustbridge 5 years ago. So mm-hmm. like 2012-ish I started.
Right.
I became a congregant. And I couldn't go for a few years because I moved to the other side of the county. And I would always hear people whispering about, like, hey, what's that Church of the Little Green Man? You know anything about that? You lived over there. And I was like, what? Oh, yeah. I can see if I can get you an invite. You know, like, maybe kind of, and people are like, really? You know, and I'm like, oh, fuck, you can go whenever. It's open to everybody. You just show up. Bring some food. It's great.
Right.
But it does have this, there, you know, a lot of the locals are like, ooh, what's that crazy artist doing over there in that
uh-huh.
church? And you happen to be across from a very prominent Sullivan County local.
Right.
Who's a good neighbor to have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that's great.
Butch Resnick's next door, and that's worked out great. You know?
Never hurts to have camels across the street.
Yeah, camels and ostriches. I mean, there may be a penguin on the pond this winter. Who knows?
Oh, my God. That'd be amazing. Hopefully it freezes for the poor penguin. Oh, that's awesome. So it's just like this whole scene.
And once again, it's kind of formed organically. You know, we all kind of have come to this area separately. Josh Druckmann at Outlier. You've got the buddies of Majestic Farm. Denniston Hill right down the road with John Letourneau and Paul Pfeiffer and Julie Maritou. You know, like all this stuff has just formed separately, but at the same time, we all kind of gravitated towards each other.
Yeah.
You know, so timing has been just on our side. You know, say from 2000, 2007, 2008, everybody started to kind of percolate, you know, in their little scenes and coalesce, you know, with the congregation, you know, and we only do it maybe three times a year. So it's not like there's a lot of effort that goes into it. In fact, it's relatively effortless, which makes it so great, you know, and two or three times a year is enough. You know, to give you this kind of sense of congregation, and you know, we're all hanging out together, we're all having barbecues together, and with no regiment, with no kind of like, okay, every Thursday we do this. You know, there's none of that. It's just catch as catch can, and everybody's kind of on board.
Who decides the themes for the church?
I'm pretty much in charge of the themes, but it's a battle constantly with the Band of All Faiths. So, you know, I kind of bring it before the Band of All Faiths, which is Josh Druckmann, Richard Travis, Sarah Buddy, Nick Engel, I'm sure I'm forgetting. Oh, Dreeky Caprice, you know, and then guests. You know, we all have plenty of guests. The original church, starting out with a band, Purple Jesus, this church also has started out with a band at its core. And the Band of All Faiths is really, it's become a little bit rock opera-ish, you know, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, that side of it, I'm no musician, you know, but I can knock out a little bit on the guitar and I can sing a little bit. And that's really part of the church that I think is one of the strongest points, because people want to sing.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a club and you go to a concert, and in your head you're kind of singing along anyhow.
Yeah.
You know, with who's ever on stage, and you know, you're living vicariously through them. So in the church setting, where you stand up and sing a hymn, people are so into it, you know, and so ready to do that.
It doesn't hurt that you have awesome hymns.
And yeah.
And you like go through the trouble of writing new lyrics and putting them in a pamphlet.
Yes. We follow the church structure,
yeah.
You know, basically, like, that's, you know, like I said, I went to church as a kid, not that much, but enough to know that, you know, the little fold program was kind of, that was how you structured your church. And I took exactly the same approach with Church of Little Green Man. So, you know, there'll be a testament and a hymn and a song, and, you know, and the hymns are just, you know, I mean, we make them as filthy as we can without, you know, driving everybody out of the place, you know, and, you know, it's kid friendly to a degree. It's kind of an adult church, but it's kid friendly, you know, and so people bring their kids and, you know, I mean, I know I'm doing something right when I can see the pictures of the congregation and there's a lot of smiles on the faces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome. So I brought, Mike came with one of his good friends and his daughter, who's 8, who had an awesome time. And
uh-huh.
You know, her family's very Catholic. Like, I just went to her communion uh-huh. earlier this year. So I'm like, okay, we're going to go to a different church. And if your mom asks what kind, just say Protestant. But, you know, she's sitting in church and I was like, what do you think? And she's like, this is weird.
Yeah. Well, see if we can get some converts. You know?
Right? She's totally in. Once she ripped apart the Gandhi filled with candy Hug the Mahatma, fucking brilliant. I loved it. And I was like, they don't get it. It's so great. They're just like ripping Gandhi to pieces. I was like, oh, yeah. That's good.
Yeah. As long as you pay them off with candy, you know, you'll get them to cooperate.
Yeah, she didn't want to. And I was like, there's candy in there. She goes, what? And the cigarette. And she was, after church, she's fucking in the lion's cage, like hiding candy.
Uh-huh.
The other kids, I'm like, well, I think we've got some more followers here.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But it's just been an experience going there and knowing that there's, because I've honestly never been to the galleries in this. I've been to CAS once for an opening years ago. But to know that the church is there and you have your artwork and you display other artists and photographers, and it's just, it's always exciting. So thank you for doing that. Yeah,
my pleasure.
Yeah. And I'm excited that it's, you're doing it more.
Yeah, I want to do it more. And actually, we're going to have a little sculpture park coming to Mountaindale.
What?
Yeah, so this is my, I mean, right now, I really have an embarrassment of spaces. You know, I have the church. I also have the old shul for social sculpture, which, you know, we had Tessa Hughes Freeland did a piece this year. Terrence Coe did a piece last year. Usually just do it in the summer months. But I want to put a social sculpture park in Mountaindale. And so right between the post office and that little deck there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what road that is. But
Post Hill Road.
Yeah, okay. I'm Post Hill Road. In that empty lot, watch for it. It should start soon. But already made the deal with Butch that we're going to have a social sculpture park there.
Have you ever gotten any complaints about the Church of the Little Green Man?
Well, not too much directly. I had a troll once, this woman who kind of trolled me. You know, I write this blog called Hunting with Supermodels, and she was trolling me on the blog, and then there's that site Uncensored Sullivan County.
Oh boy.
You know, that really it's like such a snake pit.
Yeah.
But a couple of friends of mine were on it, and they said, "Oh, this was a year or so ago," and they said, "This woman's tearing you apart on this, and you know, like really riling up everybody that you're like some kind of Satanist." So I went on the site, and this particular woman I don't know why, but she had it in for me. But I, you know, kind of shined the light that she was really just trolling me, and it went away. Roderick, in doing this documentary, he's been searching out people who have a problem with me. You know, as many
thanks,
as he can,
Roderick.
Yeah, as many as he can find, he's searching them out. So he showed me some tapes the other day of a couple of women, you know, who are neighbors somewhere. And they had a real problem with me, but it was just misunderstandings, you know, like they, you know, I had this one piece that for a minute I had in the lion cage that was Ku Klux Klan. And it's a, you know, it was basically a Klan outfit, but it had a frowny face on it. So it was a little too subtle for them to know that I wasn't some sort of Klan white supremacist. And
but he was in a cage.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, like I say, it was misconception. But you know, people like get their misconceptions and then they run with them. So, you know, that was 2 or 3 years ago. And he just interviewed a couple of, you know, these people, and they still have a problem with me. But what are you going to do? You know, there's going to be some people that, you know, aren't going to like it. They're going to think it looks ugly. They're going to think I don't know, you know, like because of the church building itself, you know, people think that, you know, if you spray paint something on a shul, you're desecrating it. Mm. But it's just the building and it's my shul and I can spray paint whatever I want on it, you know, as long as I'm not spray painting swastikas on it, you know. Same with the church. I can do whatever I want. It's my building. They're both historical buildings,
right.
And I've fixed both of them up. So I've saved both these buildings. But people bring, you know, with them their own baggage. And so when it comes to religious buildings, you know, they're very narrow-minded, you know, and they can't see that, like, okay, maybe I'm just taking a different approach with being spiritual or being religious, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're going to have detractors no matter what you do. The whole, for this being kind of a Republican little backwater here, on the whole, I don't get much heat at all. And, my neighbor, Steve Vigliani, he's, one of the local politician. He's a member of the church. You know, he's down. When I put up a sign that said, God loves fags in English and in Hebrew, you know, some of the Hasidics had a problem with that. But, you know, Steve has my back and you know, it's freedom of speech. It's there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. So, yeah. I've had no official problems and very few unofficial problems.
That's good. Well, yeah. I only ask because if you're going to do a more public sculpture park in town, mm-hmm. That'll probably draw more attention to the church ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, that's not why I'm doing it. In fact, I want to take some attention away from the church, you know, and find a more neutral spot, you know. So for the Mountaindale Social Sculpture Park, I want this to be a little more neutral. I want to start with just an open sign. Like I have this one piece, this metal, steel piece that says open on it. I'm going to put in the middle of the park and then see what happens from there, you know, I'm not going to load it up with objects, although I probably will put some more pieces in there. I want to, take the social part, to the forefront and see what does the town want, how will they react with things going in? So we'll see, but it's always fun to have a new space to work with.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
You should get the Mountaindale Action Committee to help you.
Is there a Mountaindale Action Committee?
There is.
Oh, okay.
I know. There's like 5 members.
All right.
They organize
Excellent.
That big Mountaindale yard sale every year.
Uh-huh.
But it's I didn't know about it until they put a flyer in my mailbox.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little out of touch when it comes to Mountaindale politics. So, I'll look to you for the inside track on
this. I get a lot of questions about Mountaindale because of, the Resnicks own a lot of the property.
Right.
And it's so close to the casinos, so everyone's wondering what's going to happen. I'm like, well, hopefully you build places to live and there's a bunch of more jobs. People will move here.
Right.
So that's the plan.
Well, Mountaindale's always been a little, it's been problematic because it's off the beaten path. It used to be the destination because of the railroad. And now it's just kind of, it's a little bit to the side of everything. When you're going through Woodridge or Woodburn or the usual pathways through here, it's a little bit to the side, so it doesn't get a lot of pass-through traffic, but it still has a main street intact, and it's got great potential.
It's got beautiful old buildings.
Micheline and Raymond are there, and Beek is there now. So I think within the next 6 months to a year, there's going to be a big upsurge in energy there.
Cool. I'm ready.
Yeah.
Right around the corner.
You should be right in it.
I know. I actually looked at a space over there. I really want to open a restaurant at some point.
You should. That's what they need. I think, as anchors, they need a good restaurant, a good coffee shop, and a bar. And if you had those three things, everything else could spin around it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I can only think of one or two good places to get a decent coffee in this whole county. And I have to drive 45 minutes to get there.
It's terrible.
It's what the fuck.
Yeah.
Awesome. So we kind of skipped over, you were in your 30s in San Francisco. I just want to go back.
Uh-huh.
And then you moved to New York at some point?
I moved to New York graduated seminary in 83. In late 83, I moved to New York. I was visiting family here in, the summer of 83 and stumbled onto the East Village scene.
Ooh.
And, I was involved in my own scene in San Francisco and didn't know much about the New York scene outside of Soho. So when I came back to New York, I was going through the Soho galleries and just wandered east and ended up in Tompkins Square Park. And surrounding Tompkins Square Park were these little storefronts. And there was a handful of galleries in these little storefronts. And they were doing exactly the same thing I was doing in San Francisco. Only in San Francisco, there was no, at that point, there was no, kind of little underground district. I was one of the few people in San Francisco doing a younger traditional gallery approach.
Yeah.
There was alternative spaces, but I wanted to do, and once again, the gallery, just like going to seminary, I saw as a sculpture. I saw it as a social sculpture. I saw that if I became a dealer, it was just like being an artist, you know, that I was going to create my gallery, my stable of artists. So I took that approach. But in San Francisco, there was no market. In New York, there was a market. The art world was there,
yeah.
You know, and still is. Basically, the center of the art world is still New York. And so that district, I was blown away. And it was either close the gallery in San Francisco and move on and do something else, or move the gallery to New York. So I moved the gallery to New York in late 83. By January of 84, I was open. And I had a little storefront on 9, East 9th and Avenue A, right on the edge of the park.
And what was it called?
Mo David is my initials and middle name. So I had started using that name to write some articles under as a, you know, nom de plume, and I continued it. And I still do it to this day. Every once in a while, I'll revisit the Mo David project, you know, and nice. Do a little pop-up gallery. You know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You did an opening in Cass last year or earlier this year?
Last year, Mariana Rothen and I did a show at Cass.
How was that received?
Oh, it was great.
Awesome.
It was loads of fun. I'd always kind of steered away from showing up here, just wanting to, you know, context is very important for me. So I wanted to just kind of keep my own context and, you know, do my work, you know, around the church and the shul and everything. But Robin Winters, who's an old friend, he curated it. So it was like an invitational. So he curated it, and he invited Mariana and I to do it, and they printed up a little catalog, and it was great. It was a beautiful little space, good energy. The people were great to work with, and it was like the only gallery show I've had in years, and it was so much fun to do.
That's awesome. I'm so glad. Do you have any other... So you have the sculpture park. Do you have any other projects in the pipeline?
Working on some more music. Years ago, Josh and I recorded a bunch of songs that never really, you know, came to fruition. So I'm reworking some of those. Still writing, you know, new stuff. The sculpture park is probably going to be the next project I'm jumping on.
Yeah.
Church will be down for the winter months, also the shul. So the, in the spring, I'm hoping to, we'll do, another church service, probably Memorial Day weekend. And then somewhere around that time, Andriana Campbell, who's a curator, she's going to curate a show at the old shul. And so, you know, winter months are downtime. Right now, I just want to get up in a tree and get bow hunting. And, you know,
right now, I just want to climb a tree.
enjoy that. You know, it's hunting season. So, yeah, that's where my head goes until right before Christmas. You know,
you have some really interesting taxidermy methods.
That's
one of the first things I ever saw at your house were all the different deer that you had in that front parlor area.
Uh-huh.
That's so cool. Do you do it yourself or do you have someone?
Some of them I do myself. You know, the more sparse ones with the bones and the deconstructed carcasses, I do myself. Traditional taxidermy, I have a guy out in White Lake, Fernando Nevis. He does them, but I usually take a dead mount approach. Mm-hmm. So to me, like modern taxidermy doesn't appeal to me where they're making...
They look like they're alive.
They look like they're alive because, of course, they never look like they're alive.
Yeah.
So I like my taxidermist to... When I bring a deer in, I tell him, make it look just like this.
Yeah.
You know? And
I didn't notice. Do you put eyes back in them or you just leave them out?
No, we put eyes in them, but usually there's a little, like, right? Eyelids barely open. You know, it looks dead. Yeah. I mean, basically, that's what I want, is for it to look dead.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's for a hunter, you know, the kill is the culmination, but at the same time, it's kind of the lesser part of everything else that leads up to it. You know, the sitting in the tree for hours on end and seeing nothing, the meditative state that you get into, all that is what draws me to the experience. But then when you do, put a good shot on a deer and you harvest that deer, and the thrill that you get when you walk up on that dead animal, and that's what I want to reflect in the object, you know. So I want that kind of, you know, that to be translated in seeing that hanging dead deer.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a head on a wall. You know, the head on the wall just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, it makes it look like a trophy, whereas the way you do it, I think, first of all, my initial reaction is, oh, man, that thing's dead. Because a lot of times when you see it mounted in a live form, you're like, oh, that's nice. But you need to be reminded, like, this animal died because of a human killing it. So that's the first thought I get, like, oh, this was an animal that was hunted. And then second of all, I think you're paying it more respect by, in remembrance, like, this animal's died and I ate it.
And my grandfather was a butcher, so before I even knew how to hunt, I knew how to butcher a deer. So I butcher it up, and you know, I live on venison and wild turkey a lot of the year.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You have a big deep freezer full of venison?
I have a big enough freezer, yeah.
I've never actually been hunting myself, but it's something I've always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone target shooting, but I've never really taken the time to go hunting, I think.
Well, I had to reteach myself. I hunted as a kid, and then when I was maybe 20, you know, from living in cities, I just stopped. And then I would come back and visit, because the social aspect of hanging with my family and hunting was a big part of it, and I miss that. Yeah. But then I would do what I called hypothetical hunting. So I would go out in the woods. I would take a loaded gun with me. I would try to get the shot, and I would not take the shot. And so for years I did that, and then that became not satisfying, you know. And it just it was becoming too convoluted, and I decided, I guess not that long ago, probably, you know, 20 years ago, I decided I would try hunting again.
Yeah.
And I started small. I started with a 22 and shooting some squirrels and seeing whether, like, that tweaked me or whether that was a good feeling or a bad feeling. And I found, you know, to shoot the squirrel and to harvest the squirrel and to cook the squirrel and eat the squirrel, it was a process I enjoyed. And it put me back in the woods. And I was living on the Lower East Side at the time. It was before I moved up here.
You were shooting squirrels in the...
No, I was coming up here to hunt. No squirrels in the park. No
squirrels and pigeons.
Yeah, no squirrels or pigeons. I was coming up here, but that also was part of what drew me back up here.
Yeah.
You know, so I was still living on the Lower East Side for probably 2 years, hunting hard. Coming up here, any chance I got, I was working in bars and, like, you know, I'd work all night and, like, jump in the car and be up here at dawn, you know, and I just got obsessed over it. But I needed the art angle. I somehow couldn't convince myself to just do it, you know, and just start hunting again. I needed the separation or the reasoning of having this be my art. So I put it into the art practice and started to do salting the hides, and the early work is all gone now, because I took, you know, such a kind of low tech approach that the mice ate it and the bugs ate it, and most of the early work is gone. There's maybe one or two pieces, but it put me back in the woods, and nowadays I don't do that much taxidermy. It's expensive and it's not that important a part of my work. It's more just the activity that, like, I really enjoy, and it does give me that meditative state, you know, where I'm, you know, this spirituality and faith and meditative states and things like that don't come easy to me, and they don't come natural, and so I kind of go by, I approach them and access them through something else, and hunting does that for me.
Yeah, wow. My goal is to work up to hunting like you did with squirrels, except I'm going to start with this asshole rooster.
Uh-huh. That's not much of a hunt.
He's a jerk. Uh-huh. Probably chase him around the field for a while. But I've never taken the life of an animal before, right, besides like insects. So I was going to start there and see if it.
Right.
I used to shoot birds when I was younger with a, you know, BB gun.
Well, I'm not much of a farmer. And like to kill a rooster, I wouldn't want to do that. Like, you know, it's like. To raise animals and kill them is a completely different activity.
It's
than hunting.
And it's not, you know? It's not because I want to eat. This bird is aggressive and awful, so I need to kill it to preserve the health of my flock.
Right, right.
I don't want to do it. I brought this bird into the world
for
a reason, but now he's being an asshole and I have to kill him. And it's not the same as going into the woods and...
No, it's completely different activity. You know, I'm not a farmer, you know. I have no desire to raise animals and kill them and eat them.
Thank God are people that do, though.
But thank God there are the people that do, and some of my best friends. And, you know, there's nothing against it at all.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not wired that way. But I don't have any problem at all, you know, hunting turkey, hunting deer, hunting, you know, I mean, those are my two main, you know, species that I hunt. But I don't have any problem being a hunter, but I'm not a farmer. Just a different way of approaching things.
It's a very interesting mentality, and I encounter that. It's hard to cross that divide. There aren't many people that can, you know, I know a lot of butchers who butcher meat all day and wouldn't want to go out and shoot an animal.
Right.
They're like, that sounds terrible. There are very, like, I can think of very few people, maybe like Gary Krantz, who will go out and, like, he can shoot the cow and then butcher it, doesn't have any.
Right.
He can raise it, shoot it, eat it.
Most farmers can. I mean, you know, like I say, I grew up. You know, my grandfather would take me out on you know, calls to shoot a pig or shoot a cow, and you know, he didn't even like to do it, but that was his job. You know, he did it. You know,
yeah, you don't really want to hang out with people that like to do.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I like to slaughter innocent animals for fun.
Yeah, if they get too much of a thrill out of it, you know,
yeah, then you just hang out with sociopaths. Yeah,
that's not good.
None of that. Well. This has been an awesome talk. I like to wrap up my podcast with getting some advice.
Uh-huh.
And it can be having to do with being in your 30s, or it can be with like something, a good piece of information you can give me for surviving the fucked up human world.
Well, that's, you know, let me think.
Yeah.
I you know, it's like, my nieces and nephews, you know, now I have great nieces and nephews, you know, so I do try to impart things to them when I can. And one of the things I always impart it to my nieces is and nephews is to not worry too much about knowing what you're going to do. You know, like there's a big push, you know, in academia and I think our society as at large to know what you're going to do, know what you're going to be, and then go for it. And I think not knowing is so important, you know, and not worrying that you don't know, you know, and keep that sense of not knowing, you know. It's like it's helped me so much, you know, through my life is that I don't, you know, I mean, I know I'm an artist and I know that's what I wanted to be and I know that's what I became, a different type of artist that I never thought I would be, but not knowing how to put this, part and parcel of being the kind of artist I've become is that not knowing. And that's kept me from being bored. It's kept me from, making a lot of kind of wrong decisions for the wrong reasons. So I guess if I could tell you anything, it would be to advise you, like don't sweat it that you don't know what you want to be at 30, you know, and carry that on through every other decade, you know. Yeah. When you're 70, hopefully you'll still say, I don't know what the fuck I want to do or what I want to be, you know.
Yeah.
Carry that sense of, like, you know, discovery that, you know, who knows what the next day will bring, you know.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mike.
My pleasure.
This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Kat.
I love getting to know my neighbors.
Well, good luck with your whole podcast. It's a great thing.
Thank you. There he was. And there was a great interview with Mike. Isn't he lovely? Such a great voice. It's during an interview, sometimes I worry that the mic isn't picking up enough and I'm kind of far away from my control board. So it's hard for me to stand up in the middle of an interview and be like, excuse me, I just want to make sure that this is loud enough. But he's got a great voice. And if you get a chance to go see him at Church Little Green Man, he's usually presiding over the sermons there. And they are something to behold. Great group of people. Lots of artwork. Usually pretty good food. Lots of beer. No complaints there. Also, there's a camel across the street and an ostrich. Just throwing that in there. I do want to thank Mike for his advice at the end of the podcast. I try to ask all my guests for some advice, and what I'm getting is a resonating, just take it easy, relax, don't worry so much. And if everyone I'm interviewing is saying something to that regard to me, then it's starting to drive it home for me. And I don't relax easily, and I am thankful that I keep having people tell me to, because maybe eventually I will. Stop worrying so much and just enjoy life. Enjoy the ride. It's hard because, like Mike said, there is this kind of, especially in America, this American dream, the goal to go to college and have a career and all for what, you know? You never know when you're going to die. You never know when you're going to have, you know, amnesia and forget who you are and just enjoy being there in the moment. I guess the point is, I'm really glad that I'm still doing this podcast for the next year because I'm still learning and getting to know my neighbors. If you want to be on the podcast, let me know. Facing30, FACINGTHIRTY, @gmail.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Find me. Come be on the show. I'm also getting a portable recorder, hopefully, so I can come to you if you're within 60 miles of Sullivan County. Let me know. Cool. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day or night or morning. Bye.
Pick it up and get real gone.